Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am, of course, Carolyn Yeager. It is June 27th. I'm returning to Holocaust revisionism, which I haven't talked about since a month ago. I'm going to focus on Dennis Abey one more time because I have read the U.S. edition of his book just out in the bookstores, which is titled The Man Who Broke into Auschwitz, and I've also watched the entire videotaped show interview of Ernst Lobethal, done in 1995, which was sent to me by Eric Hunt, who just came back from a trip to California, where he downloaded this and some others. Now, all four of the articles I have written on Abey are available at my website, carolynyeager.com, and I devoted a radio program to his story on March 8th. 2010, which was only my second program on VOR. And I've talked about Dennis Abey one of the times I was a guest on Deanna Spingola's program. But now I can add to my previous critiques with some very definite facts that I didn't have before, although not much of it comes from the Lobet video. However, it contains some good things. Now, I said Lobet. Now, this fellow, Ernst Lobethal, who was a Jew incarcerated at the Monowitz concentration or labor camp, changed his name to Lobet when he, after the war, and he emigrated to the United States. And so I will probably mostly be calling him Lobet, L-O-B-E-T. He dropped the H-A-L, and sometimes people spell it H-A-L-L, so that was no longer his name. And on the videotape, he's called Ernst or Ernie Lobet, or Ernest Lobet. He really Americanized himself. Now, the first thing for you to know is that Abey copied his story from two books, which I have mentioned previously and talked about some, but mostly the first one, not too much the second one. And he certainly read these two books before he told his own story. There's no doubt about that. Now, the first book is The Password and Courage. The Password is Courage. And, you know, these are both hack books. These are neither of these are any kind of great books of history or anything. They're pretty much junk, and they've pretty much been relegated to junk by now. But they're still around, and they were at one time kind of made a big impression. So the first is The Password is Courage, published in 1954, not too long after the end of the war, actually, 9 years. Billed as the true story of British POW Charles Coward. On the back cover, he was billed as the man who broke into Auschwitz. Think about that. The book was actually written by John Castle, which is a pseudonym for, I found out, for Ronald Charles Payne and John William Garrote, who did not, G-A-R-R-O-T-E, who obviously had reasons for using for not using their real their for not making themselves the author. So the whole thing is full of a kind of a cover-up. Anyway, Charles Coward is famous because he testified at the Nuremberg military tribunals after the war, and his testimony was believed, or pretended to be believed at the time, although now it's considered mainly fiction. A movie was made about his story in 1962 with the well-known actor Dirk Bogarde playing the role of Coward. So there's no way that Abey was not familiar with this. Coward was at the very same camp that Abey was, which was Camp E-715 at Monowitz. Coward claimed to have broke into the Monowitz concentration camp in 1944, which is the same year that Abey says he did that. Now, yet Abe never mentions Coward at all, and of course, Coward never mentioned Abe. Further, Coward was credited with saving Jews by helping them escape from Monowitz, but now it's doubted that any Jews at all escaped with his help. If they did, it was only maybe two or three. So what was Coward's real role? Well, according to a reviewer on Amazon, this maybe not the best information, but it could be as good as any other that you get. So according to this reviewer, who seemed to be quite clear about what he was talking about, the Clatterbridge, which is a person's name, of the book was really Yitzhak Persky, a member of the Palestinian Jewish Brigade, or Haganah, who was at Monowitz as a British POW. Persky was the father of Shimon Peres, who became president of Israel, and who was also a member of the Haganah. This was revealed in 2001, according to the reviewer. Now, this reviewer says that Coward really did borrow a prison uniform and slip into the Jewish camp in Monowitz, not Birkenau, as he says John Castle inexplicably claims in his book, in the book that he wrote, The Password is Courage. Across the wire from E715, which was the British POW camp, to pose as a Jewish prisoner for one night. This sounds strikingly similar, right? He was looking for a Czech doctor who, it turned out, was working in one of the infirmaries, so he was not even in the camp. But Coward described what he saw in the camp with much embellishment. I'm saying all this to show that Abe had also claimed that he spent only one night in the camp. And he says, though, that he went another time. And in the book, because he's always said he went twice. But in the book, the second time, which seemed to be about some weeks later, he's not very clear. After a certain point in his book, he stops giving dates, and you're not real clear about when things were. But you have to figure it out. But the second time that he went, it wasn't even described in the book. It was just, like I said, it was just pretty much a repeat of the first visit. And the visit was so darn boring, after it was done being cleaned up by A.B.'s co-author, who took out all the nonsense, as much of the nonsense, not all of it, but some of it. So that it was a very uneventful night that Abe spent there. And so to repeat it the second time in the book didn't seem to be a good idea. So they just sort of said he went again and nothing different happened. All right. Now, so this is so clearly like the Coward book. It's almost unbelievable. An important similarity, another one between the Coward and Abe book, is in the small amount of space given to their Auschwitz period compared to the large amount of attention given to their exploits before they were captured. Even though Abe was captured already in 1940 in North Africa, in the same year that he embarked from Britain with his, war group, soldiers group, they spent 104 pages devoted to his soldiering and his escapes from earlier camps, and only 75 pages to his being in Auschwitz, as he calls it Auschwitz. And it was a part of Auschwitz. So I'm sure Abe and Broomby thought, well, if it worked for Coward, it could work for us too, because Coward's book was more about his exploits as a soldier before he got to Auschwitz than what he did at Auschwitz. So, you will find that the part of Abe's book that is about his time in Auschwitz, which is what the title of it, is about, is less than 30% of the book. And the rest of it is about Abe before that and Abe after that, filling us in on everything that we'd ever want to know about Dennis Abe. But there's some interesting stuff in that, I have to say, particularly in the last part, telling about how he worked with the BBC and developing his story and how they found Lobit and Lobit's sister and so on. But I won't be going into that tonight. Now, the other book Abe copied from is Spectator in Hell by Colin Rushton. This is a story of Arthur Dodd, another British POW, who also ended up at Camp E714 in Monowitz. Was it 715? I'm mistyping here. Okay, I think it's 715. Now, this book was published in 1999. So, and something striking right off the bat is that two out of three editions of Spectator in Hell have the same iconic picture of the Birkenau entrance on the cover as Abey's U.S. edition has. One is taken from the outside and the other is taken from the inside, but they both look exactly the same to most readers, and they look pretty, you know, the same to me. It is that famous photograph that we all associate with the Holocaust and with Auschwitz. But further, the cover design of both books, not only the image that's used, but the whole cover design is identical. That is, the placement of the parts, the title, where the title is, where the subtitle is, the authors, the image. I mean, they take up exactly the same space and are in exactly the same order. And look, so the whole thing is very similar with that same picture. So I say this can't be accidental. They were really, really copying this book. Abey takes a lot from this book. We're told in detail of Arthur Dodd's war exploits before he was captured, just like in the Coward book and in Abey's book, which again makes up a large part of Dodd's story. So they all three follow this pattern of claiming that they're about their time in Auschwitz, but the time in Auschwitz doesn't take up that big of a part of the book. But it's substantial enough to be to warrant, I guess, what they're doing. So Abey uses the phrase also, as does Arthur Dodd in his book. He uses the phrase over and over again that Auschwitz was a living hell or hell on earth. In both books, the German guards are portrayed as either Hogan's heroes types of frustrated and or lazy, or as vicious bullies who beat prisoners up or sometimes to death for no reason. There seems to be no in between. And this is typical of these Holocaust survivor books in which they're trying to portray the worst possible conditions that they had to endure. A difference between the two authors now is that Dodd was captured in 1942, but Abey was captured already in 1940, as I said. And except for a few months and a few escape attempts, he spent the entire war as a POW. And he's a little bit embittered about that, I think. And Abey actually contributed a short essay on his own experience in the camp, E715, yes, to Rushton's book. This is the Arthur Dodd book, in a section that invited other POWs to tell their own stories. Now, this is pretty amazing. In this book about POWs that was written about Arthur Dodd, and it came out in 1999, did I say, yes, Dennis Abey had asked other POWs to contribute anything that they knew or that, and they put this in a special section of the book in which they had, you know, quite a few essays or writings or contributions or whatever. Some were fairly long to the story or, you know, what they wanted to contribute. And Dennis Abey contributed one. Now, this was before he came out with his own story publicly, really. Let's see, I lost my place. Abey said nothing. Okay, this is what's important. Abey said in this contribution he wrote nothing about Ernst Lowenthal or about his swap with the Dutch Jew, you see. So in 1999, or probably he wrote this in 1997 and 1998, the book was printed in 1998, he didn't have that information. That wasn't a part of his story as a POW, which he was a POW, and he did have his experiences there. But at that time, it didn't include what he did for this Jew, Ernst Lobet, or about his swap, his breaking into Auschwitz. He didn't really break in, but anyway. But another important part of the Russian Dodd book is that it tells of three different POWs who went by the name of Ginger. This is something I want to be sure to that you know, because this whole idea that Dennis Abey is the Ginger that Ernst Lobet is talking about is based on Abey And his Lobet's sister goes along with it, which can be, it's not that convincing. It's not, I mean, it's not very strong evidence, really. That's all there is. So, you know, I'm going to show you three different gingers in this book, Spectator in Hell. One who successfully escaped in Italy at the beginning, towards the beginning of the book, with two others making it to Greece and winning an oak leaf decoration. So he can't be the ginger that wrote to Lobet's sister and saved his life thereby. Then there's another ginger who participated in an escape plan with four others at the time of the Crema 4 explosions at the so-called gas chamber by the commandos there and so on in October 1944, after which this ginger was missing, and Arthur Dodd and two others ended up back at the camp, but after their escape and being gone for several days. But he never saw Ginger again, he said, and he never mentioned him again, so he seems to be out. Although this happened in October 1944, so earlier in 1944, he could have been the Ginger who met Lobethal and wrote to his sister. Now, one person named Ginger has a last name. He's on the official list. He's on all the official lists, and that Ginger is his real name. So he's a real guy. His name is Ginger Perry, and he was transferred, according to the records, from Auschwitz to Camp E393 at Mittellaziek, or it's called Mittellaziek, some nearby camp, in January 1944. So he also could possibly have been Lobet's ginger, and I'll tell you why. I'm going to quote now from Lobet's Shoah testimony. I'm not actually quoting, but I'm kind of quoting because I've copied it very, very closely. And in this part, he says, on one of my trips to get the soup, I was always looking out for some of these POWs because I had a sister in England, and I wanted to give one of them her address. And though my English was very poor, I knew enough to say, Sister England, and I had memorized her address. I was watching one POW, you know, one day, in his khaki uniform, welding on a building by himself. He saw I was watching him and waiting for him to throw down his cigarette butt. And I need to tell you here that A.B. wrote in his book that he was never a smoker, but he said he carried cigarettes around with him. He says his uncle would send him cigarettes because cigarettes were known to be good currency in the camp, and his uncle had access to them or something, and he'd send him a certain brand of English cigarettes. And so Avi says he'd carry them around to give to prison inmates or trade for things. But in this instance, according to Lobet, he was smoking the cigarette, and he motioned. He says POW motioned me over. He gave me his half-smoked cigarette. He said, what's your name? I said, Ernst. I said, what's yours? He said, Ginger. He had red hair. He was young, maybe 22 years old. I said, I, Sister England. He said, where does she live? I said, Birmingham. He said something like, address? Do you have an address? And Ernst says he didn't understand that exactly, but he understood what he meant, and he gave him the address that he had memorized and, you know, spoke it to him. And he says that this ginger took out a pencil and wrote it down on a piece of paper and said, me write. Well, this made Ernst very happy. He was smiling in the interview about remembering this, and he had high hopes that somehow his sister would be contacted. And he says, I kept a lookout for him, for this ginger. And he says, when I saw him, I would wave. Sometimes when nobody was around, he would give me a cigarette. Now, you know, if A.B. got these cigarettes from his uncle, he could have given this Ernst a whole pack, I guess, since he didn't smoke them. But he just gave him a cigarette when he saw him. Now, the reason I say this is because later on we find that A.B. starts going on and on about what great friends he and Ernst were and how much he cared about him. And he talks about him as though he's his long-lost brother or something. So we'll get to that. Now, 2 months later, or AB says 4 months, or it was several months later. Ernst says, he saw me and called me over and handed me a letter, 10 packs of player cigarettes and a bar of chocolate from my sister. And again, he was thrilled with that. Then he says, the 10 packs of cigarettes I distributed, some got traded for future favors. I gave some to Mackie, that was a friend of his in the camp, some to one guy from our transport from Breslau, some I give to my capo. He was pretty good friends with his capo. And he said his capo was okay. And it went, he said. Oh, yeah, then he remembered. And I used I used 2 packs. He said the soles of my shoes had begun to wear very thin, and, of course, there were also shoemakers in the camp, and I had new heavy soles put on my boots for 2 packs of English players' cigarettes. And that, later on, came to save my life on the death marches that took place in 1945. Now, that's the part that has been on, not all of it, but this last part has been on the, has been known for some time. That's the part that the BBC likes to play to show that AB actually saved his life because of the cigarettes he was able to resole his shoes. Now, the fact that he says there are shoemakers in the Jewish camp or in the work camp with leather for soles is kind of significant. It's another clue that these men were not, that the Germans were not trying to kill all these men through purposely starving them and working them to death, rather than that they wanted them to survive and continue to work. Anyway, AB also says something different. He says that he gave the cigarettes to Lobet in installments because Lobet couldn't conceal 10 packs or even several packs at once in his clothing, but Lobet just says that he gave him 10 packs of cigarettes, and that was it. Now, he said what the sister's letter said because the interviewer asked him, and he said the letter said, "Dear Ginger, I'm so glad that you are well and with my brother." So it obviously, he says that this Ginger wrote to her and made out like he was another POW or something, or that he was with him and that they are both okay. And to not say anything that would get him in any trouble with the censors for the letter. And, he said it was very innocuous, and he said that Ginger showed him to tear up the letter after he had read it, and he said he couldn't read it, but he had a guy in his block translate it all to him. And then after he learned what was in the letter, he destroyed the letter. But he said it was very innocuous for that reason. So then Lobet says in his testimony after this that this happened in 1944. He said, "I'm in Auschwitz. I got a letter from my sister in 1944. And he never mentions Ginger again. Yet, as I said, I mentioned before that Ginger, in his book, even more than in his previous interviews, just gets carried away talking about the ongoing friendship that they had. Even there in the camp, somehow they always managed to, he managed to talk together and he acts like he's just so concerned and had so much feeling for this Lobet. But I think not, because Lobet, according to what Lobet says in his testimony, Ginger was just someone who happened to come into his world there then and did him this favor, which he really appreciated. And then he forgot all about him. I mean, he never talked about him again in the interview. But Dennis Abey that's trying to make a big relationship here and play up the fact of how much he helped this Jewish Ernst Lobetal. So one point from here on that I'm trying to make with this is that, with this telling you about the three gingers, is that ginger was a common way of referring to redheaded soldiers. And there were some, there were quite a few redheaded soldiers, probably, in the British ranks. There's a lot of redheads in the United Kingdom. Therefore, Lobet's ginger could very easily be someone other than Dennis Abey. Lobet died, but I don't know that he is. I'm just saying he could be. Lobet died in 2001, and now A.B. first told of his experiences at Auschwitz in 2005 when he was on a panel on a BBC radio program about war pensions for veterans. He used the phrase, hell on earth, which he continued to use and is still his favorite, as I've said before. In 2001, when Lobet died, A.B. had actually given a five-hour interview to the Imperial War Museum. 5 hours, because they were now they were trying to get testimony from all these war veterans, and he was one of the few left. And yet he did not mention the swap. And when recently asked why he didn't mention that in that long interview, he said, "I don't know why, I didn't choose to." And he said mumbled some other things, but that was all he could come up with. He just, because he didn't have that story at that time. That's why. This story evolved over a period of time as he began to think how he could put these things over on the way others had done. All right, I will finish this, a little bit of what's left of this, and we'll open my second topic when we come back from the break.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
A flotilla carrying humanitarian aid bound for Gaza is set to depart from Greece. Now, Israel has already warned that it won't let the convoy reach its destination. It also said foreign journalists who take part will be banned from working in Israel for 10 years. Artis Polosuia now has more details from Tel Aviv.
Well, the mission has been called Freedom Flotilla 2, and it consists of 10 ships comprising some 350 activists from 22 countries. Now, the plan is for them to set sail from Greece later this week, but we're already hearing from one of the ships, which is an American ship. It's being called the American Boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope. It complains that the Greek authorities are not allowing it to leave, and in a statement that was read out by passengers on board that ship, they accuse the United States of using leverage has with the IMF to put pressure on Athens, who at this stage is seeking economic bailouts. In a separate development, the Israeli government has warned that any journalists who plan to set sail with the flotilla will be deported from Israel and prevented from re-entering the country for another 10 years. That first flotilla was at the end of May last year, and at that stage it consisted of 6 ships. They set sail from Turkey, but that attempt ended in disaster when Israeli commando units stormed the largest of those ships. It was a boat that was operated by the IHH, that Israel considers an extremist organization, but which Turkey insists is a humanitarian organization, and 9 Turkish citizens on board were killed. Now, in an effort to prevent a similar kind of outcome, the Israeli Security Cabinet has been holding an emergency meeting today, the second such meeting in 2 days. It's trying to look at alternative ways of dealing with this flotilla, but the latest word we have is that it is saying that it will not allow the ships to dock in Gaza, that they have the options of either docking at the Israeli port city of Ashdod or at the Egyptian city of Al-Arish, and already Cairo has indicated that it would assist the ships that plan or in fact decide to sail there. The Israeli authorities saying that they need to check the cargo on board, and only after they are satisfied that there are no weapons and no ammunition will they then take the commitment upon themselves to deliver the goods in their entirety to Gaza. Now, it is important to remember that this blockade that Israel has imposed on Gaza has been in place since 2006. But since then, citizens of Gaza have been unable to receive many basic foodstuffs, many items. In the last year, Israel has eased restrictions, but still, humanitarian organizations both inside and outside Gaza claim that the situation is deteriorating, and they talk about a humanitarian disaster.
Now today, President Obama meets with top Senate leaders on the debt. They are trying to resolve the stalemate that we have seen going on. Now, nothing has worked yet, so will they accomplish anything this time? Or is this just political theater, as some argue? Joining me now is Raj Doshi, his president of Manny Capital, to tell us what
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn, and I'm going to finish this little bit that I wanted to say about Dennis Avey before I go on into the next segment I have planned. And what I want to point out here, and what I was pointing out, is that it's not certain that Dennis Avey is the ginger that Ernst Lobit talks about. The one thing that the BBC, now, let me put it this way. Dennis Avey began working with the BBC staff in earnest, you might say, in around 2005. And Rob Broomby, a journalist there, and his producer, a producer, Ron House, got very interested in Avey's story because they thought, well, if we can confirm this story that he tells, we've really got something. You know, we've got a special new big Holocaust story. So they were working very hard. They finally decided that to find some proof of what he was saying, which they couldn't do. But they finally decided that they had to find his Lobet's sister, who lived in England, and find out from her if she could confirm that yes, she remembered Avey, and because supposedly they had met very briefly in 1945 when Avey got back to England, and he looked her up. So they took a long time, but they finally found her. And when they did, she obviously said, yes, I remember him. Yes, he's the one. Now that's, that doesn't convince me a whole lot because I know how these people do, you know, she's Ernst Lobit's sister, a Jew. And the Jews are all for this story. And, you know, it's all about a Holocaust, wonderful Holocaust story. And she learns about that. And so she goes along with it. Now, she could be telling the truth or she could not. But I don't think that her witness is the most compelling. But that's all they have. That's all they have. And you also need to know that there's two parts to Avey's story. One is the Ernst Lobit, who supposedly he saved this Jew's life. That's the big thing there. He saved his life by writing this letter, going out of his way, you know, sort of putting himself in a little bit of danger by supplying, you know, getting these this gift. Why didn't he just give him the cigarettes his uncle was sending him? I don't understand that part. But anyway, his sister sent all these cigarettes, and so he gave them to him, and this saved his life. Now, the other part of the story is the Dutch Jew is the swap, what Avey calls the swap. That's what the title is, the man who broke into Auschwitz. So when he swapped places with this Dutch Jew for one night in the Monowitz camp, one of them anyway, and he had to make a deal with a couple of his POW friends. He said he mentioned two of them that nobody had too many dealings with. And he had to make a deal with the capo of the barracks that he was going to be going into, and two of the prisoners, and all these people were involved. He finally had to admit that, but somehow he kept it quiet. And when he went in there, he didn't talk to anybody except these two. Went straight to the bed he was supposed to have, and they hid him there. So he really didn't see much or do much. I mean, it's just kind of nothing. But these two things have nothing in common. They are totally separate events that he is basing his claim to fame on. All right, now, another thing I need to mention is that Avey, of course, like Dodd and probably Coward, I haven't read Coward's book, but, you know, describes the guards in the camp as acting quite a bit worse than we think that they have, we believe they've done, they did. And he also described that they did in other camps where we know they treated the British POWs and other certainly European POWs. I'm not too sure about the Russian POWs, but quite well. And they followed the Geneva Conventions and all that. But they want to say that, they witnessed all these terrible brutalities, and they want to bring in the SS as often as they can. And, you know, the British POWs were totally under the supervision and control of the Wehrmacht. They had nothing to do, the SS had nothing to do with the POWs, but they were there, you know, at Monowitz, and however, not in the capacity that people like A.B. want to make you think. So I want to just quote one thing that A.B. wrote in his book, and this is also something that he included in that contribution he sent to the other accounts section of the Arthur Dodd book. So this is one of his favorite stories. Now, here it goes. I watched a female SS officer attempting to extract the last dregs of life from a male Jewish carcass. She punched the pathetic figure to the ground with her fist and, picking up a substantial rock, crashed it down on his head. This elimination of life from a tormented body was an everyday occurrence. And these bestial acts, together with the memory of the repulsive stench of burning flesh, still bring depression and nausea to me. Now, this is an example of Dennis Abbey's true story. You know, he tries to tear into the SS as much as possible. And yet Lobet stated flatly in his testimony that I have seen, the administration of the camp was absolutely and totally in the hands of the inmates. And he often said that he never saw any SS to speak of. When the interviewer asked him about that, he said, we never saw them. He said everything was done by the inmates. Everything was handled by the capos, the block leaders, etc. And he said the SS were never in the camp. He said the SS guarded, they had SS guards outside the perimeter of the camp. And I get the impression that there were SS at the Farben work site sometimes. And, of course, they were. But at the same time, the Farben people had an agreement with the SS that they were employing these prisoners. And they paid the SS for them. And they were in charge. And they had a lot of civilians working there, a lot of civilians, Poles, Czechs, and German civilians mostly, and Italians. Who, you know, had skills and were working in skilled work and getting paid and so on. So, and then these prisoners were doing, I suppose, more of the lower level work, you know, carting things around and helping and so on. They weren't beating and killing people as Dennis Abbey likes to describe. So all in all, I found that Ernst Lobet is a more likable person than Dennis Abbey. You'll notice that, I noticed that Ernst Lobet never, well, you will notice that Ernst Lobet never wrote a book. He didn't write one of these books and saying, oh, I'm a Holocaust survivor and this is what happened to me. He doesn't tend to be a liar. He chose not to move to Israel when he had the opportunity. He's not religious. He said he never attended synagogue. He seems to be one of those better kind of more assimilated German Jews, because he came from Breslau. He wanted to go to America, and he did. And when he got there, he changed his name to Lobet, and he eventually married a non-Jewish woman and had three children. And I've seen pictures of his children grown up. They were young, too. But when they were growing up, they were quite attractive people, I must say. And Dennis Abbey seems to me to be more Jewish than Lobet in that he carries on like a Jew and wants to please the Jews. He's really quite sickening to me. I would say it's a kind of a turning of the tables in that he is using Ernst Lobet to propel himself into fame and fortune in the worst tradition of British chauvinism or insincerity. So that's the end of what I can say about that for now. You never know, I might revisit it in a future time. But I want to go on to discuss in the short time I have left, but I think I'll be able to do it, the Hoffman, what I call the Hoffman-Krampe-Zundel controversy, which is not really a big controversy, but there's been some emails and open letters and newsletter commentary circulating. And I see in this an important debate that should be had on the effectiveness of different styles of Holocaust revisionism. You know, I've made my position clear in the past. In fact, the first time I did so, I was, or I should say the first time I was on a VOR program was as a guest with Thomas Sunik and on his Sunik Journal. The date was December 16th, 2009. Now, Tom didn't really know anything about me except that I was descended from Donaueschwaben, of which he approved, and he wanted to talk about that, but I really came on to talk about some other things, and I wanted to make clear to Tom that I believed the mighty effort that had been made to mitigate this anti-Germanism in history could not succeed as long as the Third Reich continued to be demonized as evil. And I said the Third Reich was German, and Germany could not separate itself from it, as it seemed to be attempting to do. And by many, many Germans, German-descended people all over the world, as well as today's Germans in Germany, today's Germans in Germany. And they do this, in my opinion, and I think, I don't know what I exactly said on that program, but it was that it's because they feel they have no choice. That is the only way out of the problem, is to somehow say we have nothing to do with Adolf Hitler. We want to kind of remove Hitler from our history and just look at us as we always were without the Hitler era. And Tom was gentlemanly, as he always is, but I know that's not what he thought I would be saying, but he let me say it. Anyhow, this remains my firm conviction. I'm going to try to explain a little bit where I'm coming from and why I think this is important. The current debate between, I'll call it a debate, it's not really a debate, but whatever it is, between Hoffman on the one side, Michael Hoffman, and Hans Krampe and Ingrid Zundel on the other, well, I side with Krampe. Now, Ingrid, I know, does not like to bicker and has said in the past, and even to me personally, that we can and should work with anyone on our side. I put that in quotes, on our side, even if we differ in details. Well, my position on that is that I don't want to point the finger at anybody, and I'm not doing that. I hope I'm not intending to do that. I'm not trying to start anything or you know, raise any fan any flames here. But as a philosophical argument, which is this is a philosophical argument that's highly important to my mind. First, I don't think that we can consider people, quote, on the same side, unquote, if they differ in essential details, which become to me not details at all, but basic premises. Now, the difference here is whether revisionism, and let's understand that when I say revisionism, I mean what's known as Holocaust revisionism. That's what the general public thinks of when you say revisionism. The difference is whether revisionism can be divorced from World War II revisionism, in which Adolf Hitler plays a leading role. You see, you can't take Adolf Hitler out of World War II revisionism. You can try to take him out of Holocaust revisionism, which many people are trying to do, but I say it can't be done because, as I said, Adolf Hitler is a part of World War II, and World War II is a part of Holocaust, or Holocaust is a part of World War II, and it's all in there together. You can't pretend like some of it, we're just not going to talk about this part of it. Now, Michael Hoffman has said in his most recent essay or response that I have seen, which appeared, I think, last week or the week before, some very disparaging things about Adolf Hitler. Of course, we all know that Hitler is considered fair game. And so people do that without having a second thought about it. They think they're on this obvious side of right and the obvious side of what all intelligent and decent people think. And so they don't consider anything wrong with that. But for those who do not share that view, these kind of words can be painful to listen to from those who are supposedly on our side. And no, we cannot work with people who hurt us so deeply and don't think anything about it, but we'll be very outraged if we give our opinion of their heroes. Because, for a lot of people, Adolf Hitler is actually a hero. Now, let's look at this. Adolf Hitler is the stumbling block. That's how I see it in Holocaust revisionism. The problem that we run into is what to do about Adolf Hitler, because there's all these people who want to like him and And they're not accepting that we can just blot him out and leave him out of it. And I refer to Jesus Christ as a stumbling block. Actually, didn't Jesus Christ refer to himself as a stumbling block? In the Gospels, he said that because he called himself the Son of God, a lot of people could not, particularly the Jews and the Pharisees, could not accept that. That was outrageous to them. But he didn't give it up. He would not say, well, I'm not that, so that he wouldn't offend all these people. He insisted that he was. And, of course, to my mind, what his meaning was, well, you are all sons of God, but you don't know it. But the difference of me is that I know it, and so I will say it. But this was outrageous to so many people, and they couldn't accept that. And in the same way, I see that if we're going to, in dealing with Holocaust revisionism, I'm not trying to equate Hitler with Christ. I'm only trying to say that he is a stumbling block, and people are stumbling over him all the time. And what are we going to do about him? Now, philosophically, I can agree that that interjecting religion into historic revisionism is every bit as wrong as interjecting Hitler. I mean, people interject religion into it all the time. At least Hitler is a historical figure. Now, I'm certainly not interested in getting into a religious debate about Holocaust. I really don't like that. Then you get into comparing the murder of Jesus to the murder of the 6 million and things like that. I refuse to go there because this is a historical debate, a historical question. Yeah, you know, I'm sick of religion sticking itself into everything, something that is perpetuated by those with a basic religious view of life and the world and even history. Now, I have a lot of friends and even followers of my programs who are very religious, and I don't mean to be hurting their feelings. I'm just saying that personally, I don't think religion belongs in these historical debates. And to me, this is a historical debate. I want to keep it historical. And this offends me as much as people are offended by bringing Hitler into it. But, you know, at least, as I said, Hitler is a historical figure. So he fits in here. Now, let me return to the point. First point is, we want the truth about what happened to the Jews. That's what it's really, Holocaust revision is all about. What really did happen to the Jews during that time? Now, at the same time, I'm talking about these universal we out there. We don't want to change anything about World War II history as regards the Nazis. The Nazis have to remain the bad guys, and we can't do any kind of rehabilitation of them. That's the big thing that people say. Are you trying to rehabilitate Hitler? Well, we can't have that. So we're looking at this. We're supposed to be looking at this anew, but we can't look at that. We can't allow any change in that, which means that maybe the Jews aren't telling the truth, but we don't have the same doubts about Hitler's role. We don't say, well, maybe Hitler wasn't so bad after all. You know, we're saying maybe what happened to the Jews is not what they've said and not what everybody said, but when it comes to Hitler, we say, we can't look at that. We can't change anything about that. Now, see how that works? Now, everything has to be up for revision. Everything. If you're going to do revision, historical revisionism of this period, everything has to be up for revision. And some people who understand that are the people at CODO. But the people at CODO, as much as I love the people at CODO and I work with them, and some are my very good friends of mine, and I'm not talking about all of them, but generally CODO doesn't want to touch Hitler either because it's bad for business. And that's basically what it's all about for many. And I don't say that to put anybody down, because we all have to be concerned. We're all trying to reach out and reach people. And if it's bad, if Hitler is bad news for that, then they say, well, we're going to stay away from that. I mean, even VOR, at VOR, people have strong feelings about that. Some, you know, they don't want too much Hitler going on here because it's bad for business. Now, we have another point here. Another problem is the Catholic Church. So many Catholics shun Hitler in defense of the Church. They're all about the Church, and they think Hitler's bad for the reputation of the Church because Hitler was a Catholic, and, well, there's a lot of things I could go into. But for them, the health of the Church is more important than the health of history or the health of European Western civilization. And I do believe that that is true. And this really needs to be looked at. And so to stay viable, the church cultivates non-European people. There is another thing to look at. Those who are working so much in defense of the Catholic Church. And I defend the Catholic Church, but not in areas like this, not when they're doing this, I don't. Now, Hans Krampe sent out an email today with another commentary on Michael Hoffman's revisionism. It was long, and I'm not going to go into it, but there's one part that I thought was something of a new idea, and I really liked it because I feel this, I resonate with it. And he said this: "My feelings seem to reflect what most expatriate Germans feel, if they are honest, namely that I'm truly homesick for the country Germany would have developed into under the leadership of Adolf Hitler had the Allies not forced a genocidal war on her. It would also probably have contributed to a much more peaceful, just, and prosperous world." Well, are we able to consider ideas such as this? That's my question. And discuss them with open-mindedness and thoughtfulness. Because that's really what it's all about. And that's what I am working toward with all my with my radio programs, all my writing, everything. I'm really working toward being able to discuss ideas such as this in open-mindedness and without people shutting down and getting angry and saying, this is terrible. This is going to ruin everything. We can't talk like this. But I say, who's going to be harmed? And we have to ask that question. Who's going to be harmed and what is going to be harmed if we talk like this? Now, you don't have to agree with it, but I'm just talking about what should be up for revision. Now, I'm almost done here. Good timing is working out well. Back to my own original ideas, I say, there will be no proper correction of what is called the Holocaust, no proper correction of Germany's role in the 20th century, no lifting of this horrible cross that's been laid upon Germans, as long as the Hoffman brand of Hitler hate remains in place. So many Germans think they can reject Hitler, bury him. You know, Michael Hoffman is German, and he's probably more German than I am. I believe he speaks and reads German, which I don't. All these people are German. Hans Krampe was born in Germany and lived there up until, for quite a while. And then he moved to Canada, and he's a, so he's German, speaks German as a native, and Ingrid Zundel is German and speaks German and grew up, you know, as a German. I mean, she was in a German community, was born and raised in that. Of course, she went to South America as a child, but when she was still pretty young. But, I mean, they're all more German than I am, and yet I feel my Germanness. And so I'm into this thing. So so many Germans think they can reject Hitler, bury him somehow, and bring the German nation, with all its great accomplishments, which they certainly revere and want to do this, back into the world's good graces, if they can get Hitler out of there. You know, if they can make us all forget Hitler and shove that, bury that, and now we're going to just see Germany without Hitler, without the Third Reich, and everything will be fine. But, you know, my view, and I've been saying this all along, is that the world, and especially the New World Order world, cannot forget or bury Hitler and the Nazis because it's founded on it. They will never forget Hitler. And I don't want to forget Hitler either. And so many real Germans don't want to forget that because that time is not understood by so many. But it's a part of Germany, absolutely. So, it can't go away. We can't go that direction. That's what I keep saying. We have to deal with Hitler. He has to be dealt with. And if in dealing with Hitler, Hitler is rehabilitated, because that is the correct history, and forget the religion part of it, well, so be it. I mean, right? If it turns out that Hitler is rehabilitated, which I think will happen in time, I believe that because I believe that's where the truth will lead us. But it's a process. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But we have to, in my view, and this is what I wanted to say tonight based on this stuff that's been going around between these people, this is a debate and a question that we have to welcome and accept and deal with and see where it goes. Well, I'm glad I was able to say this. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.